Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
City of Duluth will host a convention for Hollywood executives.
This was the excitement when the Independent Television Festival, now known as Catalyst, announced it was moving to Duluth.
$1.5 million is expected to be pumped into the city's economy.
Now, nearly 2 years later, we take a look at their financial records since then. Plus,
which is when I made my way to the Stimson, taking on grain at Harvest State's elevator in Superior.
He's an author who thrives on the grittiness of Superior.
This place, Superior, fell right into my hands when I began to realize what I had here.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Duluth will host a convention for Hollywood executives.
This was the excitement when the Independent Television Festival, now known as Catalyst, announced it was moving to Duluth.
$1.5 million is expected to be pumped into the city's economy.
Now, nearly 2 years later, we take a look at their financial records since then. Plus,
which is when I made my way to the Stimson, taking on grain at Harvest State's elevator in Superior.
He's an author who thrives on the grittiness of Superior.
This place, Superior, fell right into my hands when I began to realize what I had here.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Nearly 2 years ago, we brought you a special report on what many in local media were billing as an exciting new economic development opportunity for Duluth. The organization was the Independent Television Festival, which renamed itself after moving to Duluth as the Catalyst Content Festival and its affiliated Catalyst Story Institute. Our report ran in two parts in July 2019. The first, on July 5th, gave an overview of the organization's history up to that point. Part of that history includes a long-running deficit by the festival, which has never broken even since starting in Los Angeles in 2006 and heading to two different towns in Vermont before arriving in Duluth. Recently, the IRS has made available the nonprofit filing for Catalyst covering its first year of operations in Duluth. We'll take a look at that, but first, here's an excerpt from our first report from July 5th, 2019.
The city of Duluth will host a convention for Hollywood executives known as the Independence Television Festival.
The city of Duluth and the entire region has a golden opportunity this fall to become part of a growing creative industry. Duluth will host ITV Fest, which brings together...
Duluth is set to receive a big national spotlight.
The big announcement for Duluth today, $1.5 million is expected to be pumped into the city's economy because it's the new home of the Independent Television, or ITV Festival.
The Catalyst Content Festival is coming to Duluth as a place for budding TV producers to exhibit their work and maybe pick up a contract from HBO or Netflix, who will also likely be sending executives to town, shopping for series and new ideas. The event began in Los Angeles in 2006 as the Independent Television Festival, or ITV Fest, and then moved to the small hamlet of Dover, Vermont. There, it was taken over in 2013 by Phil Gilpin Jr., a native of the Boston area who worked for several years behind the scenes at HBO. His roots in Dover include his parents running a bed and breakfast there, and Gilpin also ran several small enterprises. The ITV Fest would be his largest, promising to bring tourists and their pocketbooks to Dover and also encourage TV producers and filmmakers to consider the area as a location for their productions. I spoke with several people involved with the festival in one way or the other in Dover, and there's general agreement it was a pretty impressive annual event. But it wasn't cheap. Gilpin sought support from the town, requesting annual grants in the $50,000 range. When his last request was only approved at $35,000, he moved the event to Manchester, Vermont, a town of about 4,000 people, more than twice as large as Dover, and more than a century of catering to the rich and famous. Manchester hosted it in 2017 and 18, yet it too found the monetary support to be too rich for his taste. Gilpin says he was encouraged by the entertainment industry to expand and shopped around again for a new home. Last fall, he found Duluth. Earlier this year, the Duluth City Council approved a $50,000 grant to the festival out of tourism funds. Yet despite widespread media coverage, the finances of ITV Fest have not appeared in any widespread media reports until now. Wisconsin Public Radio looked at the tax filings of the ITV Fest for 4 years, 2014, 15, 16, and 17, and found it has carried a six-figure debt for each of those years. I spoke with Phil Gilpin about the returns earlier this week.
All right, go for it.
Okay. So in the 2014 990, your federal tax form, you ended the year with a balance of negative $141,672. In 2015, it was $130,462 negative. In 2016, it was negative $146,268. And then in 17, it went up, or the loss increased, to negative $274,250,000. So the first question on that is simply, is it viable? Is it sustainable?
The organization itself, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, so we had a choice to make. So the organization started in 2006 in Los Angeles and was out there for 7 years. And then when we took it over and moved it to Vermont, the business philosophy that we were operating on was the first couple of years, we would have to do a really good job of proving the organization all over again, proving that we could bring people into for the festival to town. So we did, and we had assumed that as we brought more and more people in and brought in more revenue, that the community and state and regional support would increase. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. There were some small increases here and there. There were also some decreases. So we decided to double down. And after the first couple of years, we said, okay, let's find a way to bring in even more executives and bring in even more talent, and let's just grow at a whole nother level. So since there weren't any grant or funding sources available to us in Vermont that were interested in what we were doing, because there was a little bit of a misunderstanding, I guess. A lot of people saw us just as a festival event. They didn't see us as the full economic development organization that we are for the arts. So we went out and found other sources of money to borrow in order to keep the organization growing. Again, under the assumption that if we kept doing a better and better job, eventually there would be a turnaround in the support in the local region and statewide for film and TV in general. And that just never happened.
Mm-hmm. And that support, that outside support, included $262,697 on the 2017 report, return rather, that is described as unsecured notes and loans payable to unrelated third parties.
Yeah, there was a combination of bank loans and philanthropists and other supporters of the organization who were willing to bankroll, the expansion that we wanted to undergo that I was just describing. So I don't have the forms in front of me, but I have to look exactly, but I'm pretty sure that's what that refers to.
That was an excerpt from our report from July 5th, 2019, about the Catalyst Content Festival after its move to Duluth from Vermont. Catalyst Executive Director Phil Gilpin took exception to that report, calling it unfair, and he met with us to go through the organization's finances in detail. Specifically, we looked at its filings with the IRS for 2014 through 2017. Here are excerpts from our second report on Catalyst a week later on July 12th, 2019.
When I heard the piece that you did, it made me think, you called me up last week and asked me to trust you, and then that dissipated. But it made me think that, if I'm somebody who is living in Wisconsin or Minnesota and has a dream of telling stories and wanting to be a TV or a film artist, and they hear about Catalyst and they get excited about it. Maybe they've heard about it over the last few months. Then all of a sudden they heard the way that you edited together that piece last week. The introduction to it would be that this organization is either hiding something or that there's something nefarious going on. And it could dampen that person's enthusiasm who maybe has been really excited about wanting to come out in October. And who knows if they're even going to listen to this follow-up interview. You may have just completely ruined it for somebody I mean, you made it sound as if we were hiding information that is generally public, and you didn't mention that it's public. You know, a lot of this is trying to dig into maybe stuff that potentially could be seen as negative from the past in Vermont, or people who maybe didn't like us there, or things like that. And I can just tell you from the start, I'm never going to speak negative of anybody, especially a place that we've been, and especially a place where I have family. So, you know, on that front, I just really want to know, kind of my question to you would be, the skepticism with which you opened and which you presented about our organization from the start, I'm really curious to know what's driving that, where that comes from. Is there some type of fear behind either me or the organization, or I just don't know what it is that, for all the good work our organization does and the good people around here that are working to accomplish all of its goals and all the opportunities that we can give to creators and people, how does the skepticism help them? And I'm being serious, because skepticism is not, you know, something that's only to you. Obviously, an organization moves into a location, you know, and you're not the first skeptic we've met, and we probably won't be the last.
Right.
But to you,
well, in the interest of time,
but to you and all the other skeptics listening,
let me answer it.
I'd love to know, how does that help that creator that's sitting out there that maybe now feels a little discouraged?
Skepticism I will take as a compliment, actually. I'm a journalist, an incurable journalist for about 30 years, and skepticism sort of goes with the trade. Maybe I'm deluded by taking that as a compliment, but
I don't think it's deluded. I think that there's responsible and then there's irresponsible skepticism, and my belief is that you cross the line into irresponsible skepticism by leading with it from the start and in terms of the way that you did. And like I said, the big piece is you left out telling your audience that the information, the financial information you were referencing, is public. To me, that was really jarring.
The point there is that it was public, but it was never made public by any of my dear friends in the media. Wisconsin Public Radio
is
the first one making them public.
A listener tuning in last week and hearing that clip you did would have thought that that information wasn't public and that it was something that maybe we were hiding. And I really would have appreciated had you said, oh, by the way, everybody, just so you know, this is public information. That's all.
Most of it is public information. Some of this I have now from interviews with people, so that's not public. So you described to me part of the sources in your 2017 return. It's part X, line 24, and it's described as unsecured notes and loans payable to unrelated third parties. And it totaled in 2017, this is the last year that's publicly available, $262,697. So those are loans. And you call them bank loans. How did you get that without collateral? Because they're unsecured.
Yeah, they were unsecured. So when we were in Vermont, like I referenced earlier, we made the decision that it was better to grow quicker. So when we had the choice of either only bringing in, you know, 50 industry executives versus maybe bringing in 80 or 90, we decided to go out and find partners and people that were really interested in our mission to loan us the money or to donate money so that we could grow the organization that way. And the financial, you know, benefit of that is it's very similar to any other business in terms of you invest largely up front, whether it's taking out a mortgage or, you know, buying inventory and things. You have those initial outlays. And obviously the hopes is that the investments you make, you recoup that money and then you make a profit so you can use that profit to keep growing the organization. And in our industry and in our festival in particular, the investment in bringing those people out is that one day there would be a major sponsor that would come out of that group of people. And
I understand that.
That did happen.
The question is the nature of the loans. These are unsecured loans. So how did you get
it's a combination of bank loans and personal loans and, you know, philanthropists and other people. So,
okay. Relatives? At one point, I thought you said relatives.
You know, everybody who's donated, or a lot of the philanthropists, they just don't like me to say their names or associations. So that's private information.
All right. When are the notes and loans in this section due?
This is where I wish you had really done more research and not stopped the clock in December 31st, 2017.
Sure.
Because this is the second part where it was really discouraging to hear what you did on the story last week, because it made it sound like maybe the organization had some type of, you know, financial problem or something. There's over seven-figure assets on our current balance sheet, but because of the fact that you decided, Robin Washington says, oh, I can only go by the 2017 tax returns. There we go. Now it ends. You didn't look into what's been happening the last 18 months since then. So, you know, in terms of when are those notes are due and when are they paid off, almost all of them are already gone, and the ones that are there for a reason. And our balance sheet is entirely positive to a very large amount. But that's not something that anybody would have known had they listened to your piece last week.
That was an excerpt from my July 12, 2019 conversation with Phil Gilpin, the executive director of the Catalyst Content Festival, about the organization's finances based on his IRS filings up to the year 2017. As you heard, he called our publicizing of the organization's $274,000 deficit in 2017 unfair, and said that as of July 2019, he had paid off most of the debt and had significant assets. Listen again.
There's over seven-figure assets on our current balance sheet, but because the fact that you decided, Robin Washington says, oh, I can only go by the 2017 tax returns, there we go, now it ends, there, you didn't look into what's been happening the last 18 months since then.
So what has been happening since 2017? Well, two more years of filings have become available from the IRS. The one for 2018 shows a deficit of $244,000, a slight improvement over the $274,000 in arrears from the year before. But it's nowhere near the seven figures in assets you just heard Gilpin say. The numbers from that report reflect the festival's last year in Vermont. Now, the filing for 2019 was recently made public by the IRS, reflecting Catalyst's first year in Duluth and the year it held its first festival here. I'll point out that this was all before the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown. In the 2019 filing, the deficit has increased dramatically to $406,000. The organization took in $750,000, $280,000 of that from government grants. That included $50,000 out of the tourism tax fund from the city of Duluth. David Montgomery is the retired chief administrative officer for the city of Duluth, a retirement that came before the city council approved that $50,000 grant supported by Mayor Emily Larson. Taking Gilpin at his word that the 2019 festival brought in $1.7 million from visitors staying at hotels and eating at restaurants, Montgomery gave a quick analysis to determine if that amount was enough for the city to recoup its investment.
I would find that shocking if they did. The tourism tax rate is 1.5%.
Right.
And to generate $50,000, you'd have to be gross spending $3.3 million.
Although we first examined Catalyst's financial record back in 2018, we weren't the only ones to do so. The Charity Navigator is a respected online evaluator of nonprofits and provides a rating system based on factors including debt-to-asset ratio. The score for Catalyst, based on the 2018 filing, was a 65 out of 100, which it pronounces as a failing grade. From the Charity Navigator's headquarters in New Jersey, spokesman Kevin Scali explained what the rating means.
So the Independent Television Festival Incorporated, which is doing business as Catalyst, does have a score of 65 out of 100 through our Encompass rating system. And so on Charity Navigator, that is a failing score. They're currently receiving credit for a program expense ratio, having an independent board of 4 out of 4 members that are independent. And they have a number of other areas that are showing accountability and transparency. The reason why they have a failing score is that they do not have a financial review. And what this means is that the financials that they're presenting to the IRS, there's no sort of outside third party that's validating those numbers. Additionally, we look for a liability to assets ratio of 50% or less. And this organization has a liabilities to asset ratio of 6,400%. And essentially what the liability to assets shows you is the organization's solvency or its long-term sustainability.
That's without taking into account the 2019 filing, for which Catalyst's deficit has doubled. Duluth District 3 City Councilor Roz Randorf was not in office in 2019 when the $50,000 grant to Catalyst was approved. I asked her if she would vote to approve a similar request given the Charity Navigator's failing grade.
I wouldn't. The whole question and the whole thing poses a really good question, and that is, how deep do we dive into anyone's finances or business practices on awarding money to anybody.
Second District Duluth City Councilor Joel Cypress was among those who voted for the grant in 2019, which he called appropriate to build relationships and see where they would lead. But with the recently released tax forms and the failing charitable rating, he says,
before pursuing any kind of ongoing relationship with the festival that involved a greater level of investment of city funds of any kind, I would, of course, want to make sure that we ask all the proper questions and do our due diligence as a city to make sure that it is the type of organization that we want to partner with. I think that what you're reporting at least raises some questions that I as a counselor would have to take very seriously.
To review, contrary to Phil Gilpin's assertion in 2019 that the organization had paid off most of his debts and had assets reaching the millions, tax filings made public since then show no such assets and debt of more than $200,000. That deficit grew in 2019 to $406,000, while the organization took in $750,000 and spent almost all of it, including $280,000 in public funds. Phil Gilpin did not respond to requests for comment on the most recently released tax records. Next week, we'll look at the organization's other initiative beyond the festival, that of attracting ongoing Hollywood productions to the region, and Mr. Gilpin is invited to join us for that. Coming up, a writer who thrives on local color, after this.
At daybreak, Eddie told me about the Shipmaster's Ball. The captains of the Arthur M. Anderson, the Beagle, the Walter J. McCarthy, and the other boats came to it. They wore dark blue dress uniforms with gold buttons.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Did you ever look out on the lake and think those boats and crews and the ports they call on would make a good story? Or maybe the antifreeze you're not sure is going to work at 20 below in your truck, or Tower Avenue in Superior with this odd assortment of industrial and retail stores? Well, if you've ever thought about weaving a story out of all that local color, somebody's beaten you to it. Anthony Bukowski is an author and professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. He's been published, now I'm going to say six, short story collections. The Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters says five, but I don't think they're counting the latest one, which is The Blondes of Wisconsin. And he lives right here in Superior, where many, but by no means all, of his stories are set. Welcome to Simply Superior, Tony.
Thank you, Robin.
So did I get most of that right, some of it?
You got it right, yeah. This will be the this is the seventh book, The Blondes of Wisconsin.
Then I got it almost right. So
yeah, right. No, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, so what was the first, and what got you started?
Oh, boy. Well, I wanted to make something of myself, and I realized when I got out of the Marine Corps in 1967, and returned to what was then Wisconsin State University Superior, I realized I wasn't going to have a career in baseball. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? How will I distinguish myself? And one day I thought, well, I know, I'll be a writer. Well, you know, how foolish I was, because I had no gift so far as I knew. And then I fell into a very good department of English at Wisconsin State University, now UW-Superior. Mm-hmm. We had a great English department then, and I had the good fortune of working with Mr. George Gott, a poet who'd been here for a long time already. When I came in 67, he took me under his wing, and I admired him and what he told me to read and what the other teachers asked me to read. And from there, I took a Bachelor of Arts degree and started to write stories and went to Brown and on and on. And eventually ended up at the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Hmm. Well, now, wait a minute. Before we go to that workshop, let's go back to Wisconsin State. What was it again?
Well, I think it was Wisconsin State University Superior.
There we go. I'm sure they had a baseball team, though. I mean, and we do have...
We did.
Yeah, and you had the Northwoods Leagues. You know, it worked for Hank Aaron.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, Robin, I had been... In 3 years in the Marine Corps, a year and a half in Vietnam, I got out of there And I thought, I haven't taken batting practice in 3 years. And it was just impossible. I'd lost whatever abilities I had and what reflexes. And so I thought better to turn toward forming some kind of career.
All right. So Hank Aaron never had to play against you. And he
ended up. Well,
it worked out well for him.
Well, it sure did, yeah.
We are speaking with Anthony Bukowski, Tony Bukowski, an author and professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and a former student at the University or the State University of Wisconsin-Superior, something like that. So where do your characters come from? And the easy answer is Superior, but where else do they come from?
Well, mainly in the east end of Superior. Superior, you know, Superior in Duluth, but principally in the east end of Superior. But then I lived in Louisiana, so some few stories I've written take place down there. A number of the stories take place as well in Vietnam. And one of the stories in The Blondes of Wisconsin, the new book, Wisconsin University of Wisconsin Press brought it out officially April 13th. One of the stories in The Blondes of Wisconsin takes place in San Diego at Marine Corps boot camp. In 1964, I tried to write the truest account of a few days in Marine Corps boot as I could write in the story. It's called the six purposes of drill. Mm-hmm. So mainly the stories are in Superior and a few in Louisiana and some in Vietnam.
Well, I did ask that question literally, but I meant where did they come from in terms of are they real people?
Well, I don't know. Some perhaps are composites of real people. But I don't know how where a writer's characters come from. I just have this feeling that I want to create something organized, coherent, and I hope beautiful, which doesn't mean that the stories always have to be uplifting. I mean, they can be about ugly people in an ugly place, but one can make beauty from that too. And I think that's what I'm trying to do, is make coherence and organization and elegance of expression, maybe, and beauty. It's a call of the heart to make something out of what I see around me.
Mm-hmm. And as you just suggested, not all those areas are very beautiful. I mean, we have our grain elevators and all kinds of gritty stuff. Yeah, right.
Well, you know, Robin, I tell you, I love this community, and I love its ugliness. There are some the weather is, to many people, abominable. I like winter. I probably like winter best of the seasons. And the city is run down, or it was run down. So many buildings have been razed now that it's perhaps not as bad as it once was. But I find in this something real.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have a reading of an entire chapter from your latest book, The Blondes of Wisconsin. Without giving too much away, at least tell us what The Blondes of Wisconsin means. That's not the chapter we're going to hear.
The Blondes of Wisconsin, the title story of the book, concerns a group of women boxers who barnstorm the state. They're the Blondes of Wisconsin. And they're barnstorming the state, largely in southern Wisconsin in small towns, Whitewater, Fort Atkinson, places like that. They go to taverns. They arrange in advance to fight in taverns. And their opponents are men. And the blondes are in great condition. And sometimes the guys who get in the ring with them are, they've been drinking and they're not in condition. So the blondes always win. And it is a story that follows their tour of Wisconsin, and they make their way up into Superior and fight in a bar in the Alois neighborhood of Superior.
And I think that's required, isn't it?
One of the competitors, the male competitors, is a punch drunk fighter, Ed the Bronco Bronkowski. He was once a deckhand on the Great Lakes on the freighter H.L. Stimson, Henry L. Stimson, and now he's living in town and suffering from boxer's dementia. But he comes out of retirement for one last fight, and he gets into the ring with the heavyweight for the Blondes of Wisconsin, and that the story goes from there.
Mm-hmm. Are these based on real people or something close?
Well, no. I've been to a lot of fights. I've seen a lot of boxing competitions, amateur and professional. And so this is a way to show my interest in that, but also from a different perspective, because these are women boxers, and they always win.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the Harlem Globetrotters and, what is it, the Washington Generals.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But the thing is, Robin, these men who get in the ring with them, you never know what they're going to do, because they might be angry, they might be bitter about something, they may not be as drunk as they seem, so it's always a risk. I mean, there's always a risk. These women are in great condition, but they don't know whom they're fighting. In the story, the women win all the time.
We're going to let that one be the ultimate tease, and you'll have to go out, listeners, and buy the book to read that, The Blondes of Wisconsin. But you mentioned something there that sets up a piece that we do have a reading from.
Uh-huh.
This is The Shipmaster's Ball. And the link in that story to The Blondes of Wisconsin that was Ed Bronkowski, the boxer. So tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, this collection of stories concerns people in East End, you know, but also a particular family, the Bronkowskis. The father and mother have emigrated from Poland, and the father works at the flour mill in East End, and there is the young brother, Ed, who becomes a professional boxer and loses 15 out of his 20 fights, and there is the older brother, Al, who works at the refinery in Superior. And Ed, of course, is the principal character. He falls in love with a woman who's the second cook on the Henry L. Stimson that sails the Great Lakes. But at the same time as he falls in love with her, his boxer's dementia is increasing. So this is a story of a family, the Bronkowskis, and of a neighborhood, the East End of Superior, and of a city. This place, Superior, fell right into my hands when I began to realize what I had here. I think that was maybe in the mid-80s that I began to write for publication. And I thought, what better place than Superior? Because no one, as far as I know, had written about Superior in the mid-80s, and I've written about it ever since. I mean, it is a unique and an incredible place, and remote, and made remote by the weather, made remote by the landscape, made remote by all manner of things. And it was just a genuine blessing for me to realize how valuable this community was for someone who wanted to write about it.
And we can't add too much more to that. We've been speaking with Anthony Bukowski, the author and professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Robin, thank you.
And here is The Shipmaster's Ball from the collection The Blondes of Wisconsin by Anthony Bukowski, read by my WPR colleague, Cynthia Woodland.
The Shipmaster's Ball by Anthony Bukowski. Ed Bronkowski is a prize fighter with 5 wins and 20 losses. He's a deckhand on the Henry L. Stimson, where I'm the second cook. We took a shore leave in Sault Ste. Marie in a room at the Seaway Inn near a Burger King on Ashman Street. There we were, the woman who'd left her husband and the man who missed his wife after many years. That didn't stop us from falling in love. In the room, I drew the curtains, unplugged the clock. Our rule was never to ask the time. And so we lay there, happy when we touched. The Stimson would cross Lake St. Clair with a load of grain from the Dakotas, past Grassy Point at the western edge of Lake Erie, past Lorain, Cleveland, and Ashtabula, before arriving at the General Mills elevator in Buffalo. We'd board her on the return trip. Until then, we'd hold each other during the off-seasons for tourists. When evening came, Ed got our supper. Done eating, he put the styrofoam containers outside the room, then checked the Do Not Disturb sign and locked the door. We whispered about what our lives meant. We'd made mistakes, helped others, even loved. Though for me, never deeply, except during the first years of marriage to Lloyd Larson of Duluth, Minnesota. Now, I loved Eddie Bronkowski. I have no idea what time it was when we heard someone in the hallway going, "Shh, shh," I said to Ed. I told him how Lloyd would say, "Shh," whenever I said anything. When I ended up with no voice in our house, I'd had to leave. Which is when I made my way to the Stimson, taking on grain at Harvest State's elevator in Superior. Ed knew this about me, but like other things, he'd forgotten. I never blamed him for forgetting. A prize fighter who'd lost 3/4 of his pro bouts, Ed was the grand champion of my heart. "Shh," we heard the man again as the door closed down the hall. A lock clicked. A chain secured a room. "Could that be him?" Ed asked. Later, we heard someone whistle as though wishing to send a message. On the second floor of the Seaway, 3 or 4 of us might have been the only guests. Knowing the door was secure and that Lloyd, my husband, couldn't have possibly found me in Sault Ste. Marie, I said, "Tell me a sweet story." But the desk clerk fumbling outside the door with the styrofoam containers from our supper distracted us. Instead of listening to a love story, I studied a map of the Upper Peninsula and paged through tourist brochures. Ed wondered whether to keep the motel stationary. We watched an old movie on TV, A Swashbuckler, then fell asleep. At daybreak, Eddie told me about the shipmaster's ball. "The captains of the Arthur M. Anderson, the Beagle, the Walter J. McCarthy, and the other boats came to it. They wore dark blue dress uniforms with gold buttons. Gold stripes circled their jacket cuffs. The company's names, Cleveland Cliffs, Interlake Steamship, Ford Motor Company, Canada Steamship, were embroidered on the blue uniforms. It was something, all right. The band, the champagne. I remember the women in beautiful dresses and sparkling jewelry. The port director, the mayors of Duluth, Superior, Two Harbors, and Thunder Bay, harbor pilots, tug owners, everyone was dressed up to celebrate the coming of the shipping season." "It was beautiful, wasn't it?" I asked. "I opened car doors, hung up coats, gave people directions. Every time somebody left the ballroom, I watched the band. The dancers swirled around." A day and night passed with stories about the shipmaster's ball, about Lake Michigan seen through sea smoke on a January morning, about the ice caves of the Apostle Islands. Then, afternoon became evening on a day in the shipping season. When Ed went to get a meal for us, I packed our things. We had a few hours before the Stimson returned through the Sioux. "I'll tell you what love is. It is everything." For years, the crew of the Stimson had looked out for me, respected me just as I'd cared for them. Then Ed came into my life. "Ed, I love you for telling me about the ball and for everything else," I whispered. With him out, I packed our clothes, our toiletries, the stationery. I knew the next time we were apart might be the last for us. During those November days in the Seaway, we'd talked of seafarers. I dreamt that the captain of the Stuart J. Court had invited me to dance. After Ed returned from Burger King and we had BK broilers, fries, and pieces of apple pie in little boxes, I danced with him. We held each other. "Someday I won't remember you," he said when it was time to leave. "We'll put our memories in these envelopes," I said. "One for you, one for me. If we get lost, people can direct us back to the Seaway Inn, Sault Ste. Marie." "Do we seal the envelopes?" "I'm not sure," I said. What he did next surprised me. He'd hidden the 2 crowns in a Burger King bag. "These are beautiful," I told him when he placed one of the crowns on my head. He arranged it perfectly. "Will you put a crown on me?" he said, then held my face in his hands. For once in our lives, we were important. A deckhand and a second cook. As we walked down Ashman Street to the locks in Sault Ste. Marie, we were the works wearing our crowns with rubies in them. Ed said if he was working the shipmaster's ball this night, he'd let us in with our crowns on, which would identify us as VIPs. Sault Control decides which vessel uses which lock. The Poe lock is 1,200 feet long, 110 feet wide, 32 feet deep. The MacArthur lock is shorter. It takes 40 to 60 minutes to pass through them. Vessels rise 21 feet if they're upbound. We were upbound. Once a vessel has locked through the Sault, it's free to proceed into the deepest and coldest lake. I can tell you that love, real love, is everything in life. And the last thing you want to do is forget it.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Good morning, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, last week we heard all about the Apostle Islands with the 50th Anniversary Symposium, which was celebrating 50 years since its designation as a national lakeshore. A lot of that was about aquatic life. How are the fish doing there?
Well, this week, the Natural Resources Board approved a new permanent rule for lake herring or cisco and lake trout harvests in Wisconsin waters of Lake Superior. And that represents a change from quotas we've seen with lake herring or cisco in the Apostle Islands of Lake Superior. Now the state has a joint quota of 1.8 million pounds, which will be split between the state and tribal fisheries. And so that means that around 850,000 pounds of lake herring will be reserved for commercial license holders. There's 10 license holders in the area, and that means they'll get 85,000 pounds apiece, which is a 35% reduction from the previous quota. Around 47,000 pounds has been set aside for sport anglers in the area. And that's because the lake herring or cisco population has been on the decline, and they actually haven't reached anywhere near the quota in the last 7 years. And so it's kind of similar with Lake Superior lake trout. They're seeing, you know, recovery of that lake trout population. It's slightly higher than what it had been around 2010, but it's still kind of struggling. So they've restricted the total amount of lake trout for the state to be 31,000. And in the Apostle Islands area of Lake Superior, that means that the sport fishery will get about a little over 12,000, and the commercial fishers will get around 6,300 lake trout under this new rule that was approved.
All right. Well, nationally, President Biden's infrastructure proposals were all the rage this week, and it's more than just about roads and bridges. It actually talks about broadband in underserved areas like ours. What's the latest on Superior's broadband plans?
Well, Superior held its first listening session for Connect Superior, which is this proposal that the city's been working on for a city-owned broadband network. You know, the city council or city council members and Superior's Mayor Jim Payne have argued that this would lower the cost of internet access by about 30% for residents and businesses. But, you know, some councilors are concerned about the price tag. You know, it's about a $31 million proposal. And this is something that Superior Mayor Jim Payne has said he would like to see federal COVID-19 relief go towards, because the city is set to receive around $17.7 million in federal relief. And as he said, you know, the American Rescue Plan Act allows that money to be used for things like sewer, water, and broadband infrastructure. And so the city heard from residents for the first time about that this week.
All right. Well, speaking of COVID, that, of course, is always a subject. How are we doing with those Johnson & Johnson vaccines that had some hiccups, or actually, I should say more literally, blood clots?
Yeah. Well, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services instructed vaccine providers this week to stop giving out doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And that came, you know, after we all know that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, FDA, recommended a pause in using that vaccine because of the potential for blood clots. It's very rare. But, you know, in Wisconsin, we've seen around at least 160,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been administered as of early this week. And so this means that health officials like Douglas County and Bayfield County have decided not to administer these shots anymore. In Douglas County, you know, they said they primarily had distributed the Pfizer vaccine, and that they'll continue to do that, and that they're reminding people too that the vaccine is also available through its new community clinic that's located at Westman Arena in Superior, and that just opened earlier this week.
All right. Well, Brooks, I always turn to you by saying, on the Minnesota side, and Minnesota was all over the national news this week, not the way it wanted to be.
No, already with national and international eyes on the state with the ongoing trial of Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd last year, we have the death of a 20-year-old black man who was stopped by police in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center on Sunday. Dante Wright was shot and killed during a traffic stop. And protests have erupted since then with more calls for justice for Dante Wright and for accountability for police violence against people of color. In Duluth on Wednesday, about 150 people filled a downtown street as they marched from the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial, the site of a lynching in 1920 of three black men, and they marched toward City Hall with demands for justice, police reform, accountability, and the overarching Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace, slogans were chanted throughout the afternoon.
We actually have some sound from the rally, where organizer Lamar Quita Leach spoke about the officer who said she shot Dante Wright because she mistakenly pulled her gun instead of her taser.
It was not a mistake. That was no mistake, but I don't think that they deserve to have guns during traffic stops, because at that point, they're not really, what do they deserve to protect us at that point with a traffic stop for an innocent person who just has a taillight out? Why do you need your gun for it?
The Duluth branch NAACP on Wednesday also reissued its demands. The Duluth Police Department bring its arrest and use of force rates in line with local demographics. White residents comprise about 90% of the city's population, but last year, half of all use of force incidents involved people of color, according to police data compiled by Lean Duluth.
Right, and we actually had a segment with Lean Duluth and Superior Chief Nick Alexander a couple weeks ago on that very subject. Moving to Park Point, a little good news on cleaning up over there.
Yeah, so if folks remember, last fall it was discovered that Army Corps of Engineers had inadvertently dumped a bunch of aluminum can shards, decades old, scraps of metal, and other debris on the Park Point Beach, this public beach, of course, that spans about 6 miles of Lake Superior waterfront. They were dredging up, you know, the harbor to keep it navigable for ships who need to pass. But they had dumped this material to replenish the beach, which has been eroded away over high water years and severe storms. So the Army Corps has taken responsibility for doing this, and they are going to clean it up at their own cost. They're also going to continue nourishing, as they call it, the beach with this dredge material. And the city has signed off on a plan to make sure that they don't end up dumping more can shards and debris. So this spring and summer, as folks visit the Park Point Beach, there may be closures or areas that are off limits for a time. Early spring and summer, the can shard cleanup should be done sometime in June, while there will be work on the beach nourishing that goes on until about the end of September.
Okay. And more good news from the Spirit Mountain area, Spirit Mountain in particular.
Yes, we learned this week that Spirit Mountain had a just a stellar season, actually, despite the pandemic, or perhaps because of it. People needed to get out and do something, right? The mountain had a 17% increase over last year's revenue and turned a tidy profits. While we don't know precisely what that will be, some of the bills continue to get paid. Interim Executive Director Ann Glumak told the Duluth City Council this week that, you know, they had cut expenses and their hiring plans, and they've got this money that the city gave them, $475,000 in tourism tax proceeds this year. And they also have a little profit, and they're going to invest it in the facilities. They're going to put in a new community skating rink. They're going to put in some more investments into their rental fleets, and they're just going to overall try to upgrade the mountain to meet what a task force and industry consultant firm said should be done to really make this a community resource. It's a far cry from the $23 million the mountain needs to invest per this consulting group, but it is a start, and the Duluth City Council seemed on board with the mountain's plans.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thank you, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. Next week on Simply Superior, we'll bring you part two of our look at the finances of the Catalyst Content Festival and Story Institute. We leave you now with an Anishinaabe song from The Vigil for Dante Wright. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.